Welcome to the Deep Dive. We've got quite a week ahead of us looking at the sources you've brought in. It seems like a really intense period, October 13th through the 17th.
Yeah, it's shaping up to be. It's this critical convergence. You've got macro policy, corporate earnings, and some pretty serious geopolitical risks all colliding in just 5 days.
Collision feels like the right word. Or maybe, as you said, a synchronized pressure test.
Exactly. Our sources keep using this phrase, tenuous resilience. I think that really nails it. The global system is, still functioning, but it feels fragile, very sensitive to shocks right now.
Right. And that's our mission today, isn't it? To cut through all the noise. There's just so much information.
And misinformation, potentially.
True. We need to identify those critical binary risks, the things that could either fizzle out or really blow up the markets.
And explain how decisions are even being made when, the U.S. financial system is basically flying blind. This data fog is a major factor.
It really is, because these risks aren't isolated, are they? They seem to be feeding into each other.
They absolutely are. It's compounding. You get high tariffs, that sparks inflation worries. Then the policy vacuum makes it hard for the Fed to react.
And all the while, we're waiting on earnings to tell us if the U.S. consumer can actually handle all this pressure.
Precisely.
Okay, let's try to break it down. Our sources point to three huge pillars of risk for this coming week. First, the geopolitical shock. We're talking brand new, game-changing 130% tariffs on China, plus this really unusual border incident in the Baltics.
And the Gaza ceasefire. That's starting its first very delicate phase.
Okay, pillar one, pillar two.
The corporate litmus test.
Yep.
Q3 earnings kickoff. And this isn't just about looking back at profits.
No, it's forward-looking, right? Especially the banks. We need to know about credit quality. That's Monday, Tuesday.
JPM Bank of America, yeah. That's the credit red. And then Thursday, we get TSMC out of Taiwan. That's the huge test for global AI chip demand, maybe the most important single report.
Oh, wow. Okay. And the third pillar.
Policy uncertainty. You've got the IMF and World Bank meetings. They're setting the global outlook, likely pretty cautious.
But they're doing this while the U.S. government is shut down and key data, like jobs numbers, just isn't there.
Exactly, that data vacuum. It throws a huge wrench into the Fed's decision-making process for their meeting later this month.
So you really have to look at this week thematically, don't you? It's not just a simple day-by-day thing.
No way. You start Monday morning, you're trying to process a Middle East peace summit alongside news about trade war retaliation.
Then you pivot straight into the banks and credit risk.
And then bam, Wednesday morning, CPI lands, the main inflation number. But without the usual jobs data context.
It really is a tightrope walk. For you, the listener, trying to get clarity, it's going to be challenging. Okay, let's dive into the first major shockwave then, the one that already hit the markets before the week even started, this U.S.-China trade war escalation.
Yeah, it went from, simmering on the back burner to a full-blown crisis almost overnight, or, well, over one social media post.
The 130% tariff shock. Explain that. It sounds dramatic.
It is. October 10th, President Trump announces on Truth Social an additional 100% tariff on basically all Chinese imports.
Additional, so on top of existing tariffs.
Exactly. You had existing tariffs maybe averaging around 30% on many things left over from previous rounds. This adds another 100 percentage points. So the total effective rate hits 130%, effective November 1st.
100% additional. That's a scale we haven't really seen before, is it? Takes us back to those really tense periods.
It really does. Our sources talk about Liberation Day levels of tension. And the trigger for this, it was immediate retaliation.
Retaliation for what?
For China's move just the day before October 9th, they announced new, pretty potent rare earth export controls.
Okay, rare earths. Remind us why they're so critical.
They're essential for, well, almost all modern high tech. Electric vehicles, fighter jets, missile guidance systems, medical
And then
scanners.
semiconductors too, right?
Crucially, for polishing advanced chips. And China dominates this market. They control over 90% of the world's processed rare earths.
So what did their new controls actually do?
They set a threshold. Any product with more than 0.1% Chinese rare earth content now needs an export license.
0.1%. That sounds incredibly broad.
It is. It essentially creates a potential choke point on a huge swath of the global high-tech supply chain. It was a major strategic move by Beijing.
And the U.S. tariff was the immediate response to show they wouldn't just accept that.
That seems to be the read. And the markets reacted instantly. Pure shock.
Yeah, I saw the numbers. S&P down 2.7%. NASDAQ got hit even harder, down 3.6%.
Right. Tech is obviously heavily exposed through those complex supply chains. And volatility. The VIX index jumped 6 points, up to 24.
It wasn't just the tariffs, though, was it? There was something else announced at the same time.
Yes, the software wildcard. The simultaneous announcement of export controls on, and I quote, any and all critical software.
But what does critical software actually mean?
That's the million-dollar question. Or maybe trillion-dollar question. It's completely undefined. Does it mean operating systems? Cloud platforms? Industrial control software? AI frameworks? Nobody knows.
That level of uncertainty must be paralyzing for tech companies.
Absolutely. If it's interpreted broadly, it's a massive threat. It could cut U.S. companies off from their Chinese operations or cripple Chinese industries that rely on U.S. software.
And invites retaliation against the big U.S. tech names.
Precisely. That uncertainty was a huge driver behind the NASDAQ sell-off.
So looking ahead, what does this 130% tariff mean for inflation, for the average person?
That's the big worry. History suggests that when you get tariffs this large, something like 60% of the cost gets passed through to U.S. consumers.
Over what kind of time frame?
Usually over about 6 months. So this throws a huge potential wrench into the Fed's plans. Just as they might be thinking about easing rates, you get this big politically driven inflationary shock potentially hitting next spring. Higher prices for a lot of goods.
Okay, so from economic warfare, let's pivot to, well, more direct military and territorial risk. Things seem to be heating up in the Baltics between Russia and NATO.
Yeah, quite significantly. We need to look at the Sotsi border crisis. This happened October 10th and 11th.
Sotsi, tell us about that.
Right, so Estonian authorities had to temporarily close this Pacific border crossing. Why? Because 7 armed Russian military personnel deliberately blocked the road. And they did it inside this peculiar bit of territory called the Sotsi Boot.
The Sotsi Boot? What is that exactly?
It's this weird geographical quirk. A small piece of Russian land that sort of juts into Estonia, and the main road actually passes through for a short stretch.
So Estonians normally just drive through that bit of Russia?
Yeah, there's a long-standing agreement. They can transit through without stopping, but they can't leave the road. Having armed Russian soldiers physically block that transit route, that's completely unprecedented. It's a clear provocation.
A deliberate test of sovereignty, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And you can't see this in isolation. It fits a pattern.
What pattern is that?
Well, remember back in September, Russian MiG-31s violated Estonian airspace near Vainlu Island. That incident alone was serious enough to trigger NATO Article 4 consultations.
Article 4, remind us, that's the consultation phase, not the collective defense clause.
Correct. Article 4 is when members consult because they feel their security or independence is threatened. It's a serious step. Article 5 is the attack on one is an attack on all clause. That triggers a military response.
So Russia is operating in that gray zone, testing boundaries without triggering Article 5.
That's the classic playbook, hybrid warfare tactics. Constant cyber attacks, these airspace violations, reports of undersea cable tampering.
It seems designed to destabilize and intimidate.
Exactly. And NATO is responding. They've intensified their Eastern Sentry operation. They've deployed more advanced air defenses like Italy's SAMT missile system, specifically to counter this increased threat level in the Baltics through 2026.
The assessment is that the threat level there is now extremely high.
Highest since the Cold War, according to our sources. It's a really tense situation.
Okay. The third geopolitical flashpoint, the Middle East. The Gaza ceasefire implementation is starting this week.
Yes, phase one kicks off Monday, October 13th. This is the Trump 20-point peace plan in action.
And the core of phase one is?
It's a hostage and prisoner exchange. The plan calls for the release of 20 living Israeli hostages out of 48 total believed held in return for Israel releasing about 2,000 Palestinian prisoners.
The logistics alone must be incredibly complex and sensitive.
Immense. And adding to the pressure, Monday also sees this major international summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Right. Co-chaired by President Trump and Egypt's President Sisi. What's the goal there?
To formalize the implementation plan, bring international weight behind it. They're bringing leaders from over 20 countries. A key goal is also to establish this proposed Board of Peace.
What would that board do?
The idea is it would oversee a temporary administration of technocrats in Gaza, focused on stabilization and reconstruction. The summit's success is really critical for the whole process to have credibility.
But there are significant hurdles, aren't there? Both inside Israel and with Hamas.
Huge challenges. Domestically in Israel, you've got strong opposition from far-right ministers, like Finance Minister Smotrich. They're publicly against halting operations and the prisoner swap. That puts pressure on Netanyahu's coalition.
And on the Hamas side.
Well, Hamas agreed to phase one, the exchange, but crucially, they have not agreed to disarm or give up their governing role in Gaza. That fundamental disagreement makes any long-term stability really questionable, even if this first phase goes smoothly.
So for you, the listener, focused on markets, right, what's the binary risk here, particularly for oil?
The base case scenario, maybe a 75% probability, is that phase one holds, at least in the short term. If that happens, you'd expect the risk premium in oil prices to ease off. Maybe Brent crude drops $2 to $5 a barrel.
But the tail risk
is severe. If the deal collapses, maybe an incident during the exchange or the summit fails, oil markets could panic. You could easily see crude spiking $10, maybe even $20 a barrel, almost overnight.
Which would trigger a massive risk-off move everywhere.
Absolutely. Global inflation shock. It's one of the biggest binary market risks hanging over this week.
So against this backdrop of tariffs, border tensions, and fragile ceasefires, we have the global policymakers gathering. Let's talk about the IMF and World Bank annual meetings. They run all week in D.C., right?
That's right. October 13th through the 18th. These meetings are where they kind of set the official tone for the global economy. And as we said, the theme seems to be this tenuous resilience and divergence.
It's interesting timing, isn't it? They're giving this top-down global view just as Q3 earnings start giving us the bottom-up corporate reality.
Exactly. The contrast could be really telling. Their main report, the World Economic Outlook, or WEO, comes out Tuesday, October 14th.
What's the expected headline forecast there?
Global growth likely staying pretty subdued, maybe around 3.0% for 2025. But the key story is that divergence.
Divergence meaning?
Meaning they're expected to actually upgrade the forecast for the U.S. economy, reinforcing that American exceptionalism idea the U.S. keeps outperforming, maybe due to stimulus or a strong labor market.
But if the U.S. is being upgraded, who's being downgraded to keep the global number low?
Europe and many emerging markets. Europe's still grappling with energy costs and those geopolitical risks we just talked about in the Baltics.
And emerging markets.
They're under huge pressure. Rising debt costs, especially with a strong U.S. dollar, are becoming a major problem. That divergence really fuels the flight to quality, pushing money towards the U.S. dollar.
And beyond the main growth forecast, they also released the Global Financial Stability Report, the GFSR. What risks are they likely to flag there?
We expect a heavy focus on two things. First, emerging markets' sovereign debt. Lots of countries borrowed cheap dollars, now rates are higher, and they're facing potential defaults. Big currency risks there.
And the second?
Shadow banking risks. All the non-bank lenders, hedge funds, private credit, there's a lot of interconnectedness and not much transparency. A shock there could spread fast. It all ties into what the IMF chief, Kristalina Georgieva, said pre-meetings. Buckle up. Uncertainty is the new normal.
Okay, so the IMF is talking global uncertainty, but back in the U.S. are the very specific immediate uncertainty, the data fog from the government shutdown.
Yeah, this is a really critical piece of the puzzle this week. The shutdown's dragging on, entering its second full week. Senate can't pass funding. You've got, what, 900,000 federal workers furloughed?
And many more working without pay.
Yeah.
But for the markets, the big impact is on the data, right? The Fed is losing its key indicators.
Exactly. The shutdown means releases are suspended indefinitely. We haven't had weekly jobless claims since October 2nd. And the big one, the September jobs report, non-farm payrolls, it's just delayed. Gone for now.
So the Fed, trying to figure out what to do at its meeting at the end of October, is missing its main guideposts for the labor market.
They're essentially flying blind on current labor conditions. It's a huge problem for them.
So what can they look at? What data are they forced to rely on?
They have to lean much more heavily on second-tier indicators. Things like the ADP private payrolls report, but that's just private sector, different methodology.
Regional Fed surveys, too.
Yeah, the Empire State Survey, the Philly Fed Index. They have components on employment and prices paid, and consumer sentiment surveys like the University of Michigan one.
But these are just proxies, aren't they? Not the real deal.
Exactly. They don't have the same coverage or statistical rigor. Relying on them just increases the ambiguity, increases the chance of misinterpreting the real state of the economy. That fuels volatility.
Okay, let's pivot from the U.S. data vacuum to China, which has the opposite problem. Not enough inflation, but actual deflation.
Right. China continues to be this deflationary anchor for the global economy. And those new U.S. tariffs are only likely to make it worse for them internally.
What are the latest numbers showing?
Well, the Consumer Price Index, CPI, was actually negative year over year in August, down 0.4%. Prices are falling. And maybe more concerning is the Producer Price Index, PPI, factory gate prices. That's been down year over year for 35 straight months. Most recently, negative 2.9%.
35 months of falling factory prices, that signals serious pressure.
Massive pressure. It points to overcapacity, weak domestic demand. Companies just can't raise prices. They might even be cutting them.
Beijing has tried stimulus, haven't they? Rate cuts, RRR cuts?
They have. They've cut interest rates. They've cut the reserve requirement ratio, the RRR.
Remind us what the RRR cut does.
It basically means banks have to hold a smaller fraction of their deposits in reserve, freeing up more money they could lend out. It's meant to boost liquidity.
But it hasn't really worked.
Limited success so far. If businesses and consumers are too nervous to borrow or spend, that extra liquidity just sits there. Now, add the 130% U.S. tariffs on top of this.
What's the impact likely to be?
Forecasts suggest it'll worsen China's deflationary pressure. It'll probably accelerate companies moving supply chains out of China. And it's expected to push the Chinese yuan, the CNY, weaker. Analysts are talking 7.40, maybe 7.5 against the dollar. A weaker currency helps exports, but signals deep domestic economic trouble.
Okay, we've set the stage with geopolitics and policy uncertainty. Now let's get to the corporate reality check. Q3 earnings season begins, starting with the big banks. This is the credit quality test, right?
It really is. This is where we find out if the story of the resilient U.S. consumer is actually true, or if high rates are finally starting to bite, pushing up defaults.
Interestingly, though, the expectation is that headline profits, the EPS numbers, will actually look pretty good for the banks.
Generally, yes. They're still benefiting from higher net interest income, NII, the difference between what they earn on loans and pay on deposits. And investment banking had a decent rebound in Q3. M&A deals picked up.
So if the headline numbers look okay, why is the market so focused elsewhere?
Because the market's looking forward, not backward. It's all about risk management. The key number everyone will watch is the provision for credit losses, or PCL.
That's the money they set aside for future bad loans?
Exactly. If banks significantly increase their PCLs, it's a massive warning sign. It means management sees trouble coming down the pike in consumer loans, credit cards, business loans.
Tuesday, October 14th is the big day then. JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Citi, Wells Fargo. Let's focus on JPM first. They're the bellwether.
Absolutely. Because of their sheer size and how broad their business is, credit cards, mortgages, auto loans, business lending, they see everything. If JPM is bracing for losses, everyone pays attention.
So the market looks past the expected $4.81 EPS beat.
Straight to the PCL figure. Remember 2008? Or even the start of the pandemic. Sharp, unexpected jumps in PCL were the first real sign that credit was turning sour, even if profits still looked okay at that moment. A big PCL jump now would suggest Jamie Dimon's storm clouds are finally turning into actual rain.
Okay, what about Goldman Sachs GS? They're more of a pure markets proxy.
Right. For Goldman, with an expected EPS around $10.48, the focus shifts to their investment banking pipeline. What deals do they see coming in Q4 and into 2026?
So it's about confidence, CEO confidence to do big deals.
Exactly. If the pipeline looks strong, it suggests dealmakers aren't totally spooked by the tariffs and uncertainty. But if the outlook is weak, it could mean that October 10th tariff shock basically froze M&A and IPO activity.
Then Wednesday, we get Bank of America and Morgan Stanley.
Right. Bank of America, BAC, is really the Main Street consumer bank proxy. Two things to watch there. First, when do they say their net interest income, NII, will peak? Management guided for Q4 peak before. If they pull that forward, it's bearish for future bank earnings.
And the second thing for BAC?
Credit card trends. Delinquencies, charge-offs. Their huge card portfolio is a great window into consumer stress levels.
And Morgan Stanley.
MS is more about wealth management. They're expected to show record revenues there. It's a stable business. The question for them is whether their trading and capital markets outlook echoes what we might see from Goldman. Is there a tariff-induced slowdown?
So the big takeaway for the entire banking sector this week, ignore the headline profit.
Pretty much. If you see unexpectedly large PCL increases across the board, that's the single most important negative signal for the whole U.S. financial system. It would trigger a big sell-the-news reaction in bank stocks, no matter the EPS, because it fundamentally means the market is pricing in a higher chance of recession.
Okay, let's switch from financials to tech. Thursday brings what you called maybe the most critical report of the week. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC.
Yeah, TSMC. It really is the ultimate litmus test for the entire global tech sector. Their position is just indispensable.
Why indispensable?
Because they're the only manufacturer of the most advanced chips, the 3-nanometer ones. These are the chips that go into Apple's latest high-end gear, and crucially, into NVIDIA's H100 and H200 GPUs that power the AI revolution.
You literally can't be the future of AI or high-end tech without them.
Pretty much. And the market knows it. Expectations are high because of this AI infrastructure boom.
What's the consensus revenue number?
around $31.98 billion for Q3. That would be up a massive 38% year over year.
38% growth. That confirms the AI buildout is still running full steam ahead.
It does. It's almost unprecedented growth for a chip cycle. But, and this is the huge but,
the number itself isn't the main event. It's the guidance.
Guidance is absolutely everything for TSMC this quarter. The market needs to know, does the company's Q4 forecast confirm this AI demand is sustainable? Are we still building out aggressively?
Or are there signs of, what, inventory digestion, customers pausing orders?
Exactly. Or are customers getting nervous about placing huge new orders because of the U.S.-China tariff situation and potential retaliation? That forward look is far more important than the Q3 results themselves.
And if TSMC disappoints on that guidance, what's the likely market reaction?
The fallout could be immediate and widespread in tech. A weak outlook could easily send the semiconductor ETF, SOXX, down 5% to 8%. It would drag down names like NVIDIA, AMD.
And pull the whole NASDAQ down with it.
Could easily pull the NASDAQ down 2% or 3% in a day. TSMC stock itself often moves 8% to 12% on earnings day. It just highlights how crucial, how binary this report is for the tech sector right now.
Okay, circling back to the U.S. macro picture, even with the data fog, there are a few key releases scheduled this week. And because of the shutdown, they take on even more importance, right?
Definitely. Their significance gets amplified. The biggest one is the CPI showdown on Wednesday morning, October 15th, 8:30 a.m. Eastern.
The Consumer Price Index for September. They expect this to actually be released despite the shutdown.
That's the current expectation, yes. And because it's the primary inflation gauge, it's going to heavily influence the Fed's thinking for that late October meeting.
How sensitive is the market to this number right now?
Incredibly sensitive, especially the core reading excluding food and energy. The forecast is tight, around plus 0.3% for the month. But because of all the uncertainty, the reaction could be magnified.
So a hotter number, say 0.4% or higher,
would likely trigger a sharp sell-off in treasuries. You could see the two-year yield jump 8 to 12 basis points almost instantly. Traders would rapidly price in a more aggressive Fed, especially a Fed that's missing its key labor data.
And speaking of missing data, the Fed needs proxies for inflation pressure now.
They do, which is why the Philadelphia Fed Manufacturing Index, coming out Thursday, becomes unusually important. Specifically, its prices paid subcomponent.
What does that measure?
It asks manufacturers in that region about the cost of their input materials. So it acts like a real-time, albeit regional, proxy for inflationary pressures in the supply chain.
So an unexpectedly high reading there would raise flags.
Immediately. It would fuel worries about inflation sticking around, especially ahead of the official CPI number. It adds to the volatility.
And Thursday also has producer prices and retail sales.
Yes, PPI, measuring wholesale costs and advanced retail sales, giving us a read on consumer spending. Normally important, but this week with the data vacuum elsewhere, they carry even more weight than usual.
Let's turn to energy markets. Oil prices seem kind of stuck in a range, but there's this big geopolitical deadline looming this weekend.
That's right. First, the OPEC Plus decision from October 5th was pretty modest. They agreed to increase production by only 137,000 barrels per day, starting November 1st.
That sounds like a compromise.
It was. You have Saudi Arabia probably wanting to regain some market share, but Russia being more cautious, worried about global demand weakening, pointing to those IMF warnings, and China's deflation.
So that small increase keeps prices fairly stable for now.
That's the base case. Brent crude likely stays in that $62 to $68 range. You got the OPEC Plus increase plus strong U.S. shale production on the supply side, balanced against those weaker global demand signals.
But then comes the weekend tail risk, the JCPOA deadline related to Iran sanctions, Saturday, October 18th.
Exactly. This is a really critical, though maybe low probability, event. JCPOA is the original 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
And Saturday is the deadline for
The other participants, particularly the E3, France, Germany, the UK, to invoke the snapback mechanism.
Snapback? What does that mean?
It's a clause in the deal that allows them to unilaterally reimpose all the old pre-2015 UN sanctions on Iran if Iran is found to be in severe non-compliance with the deal's terms.
And is Iran considered non-compliant?
Severely so, based on public reports. Their enriched uranium stockpile is reportedly way, way above the limits set in the original deal, like 30 times the limit.
So if the E3 decide to pull this trigger, the sanctions just snap back.
Instantly. All those UN sanctions, restricting Iranian oil exports, financial transactions, arms sales, they would all come back into force automatically.
Okay, what's the probability they actually do this? And what's the market impact if they do?
The probability is seen as pretty low, maybe 10%, the big political step, but the impact would be huge and immediate.
How so?
If snapback is triggered over the weekend, the oil market opens Monday, facing the sudden removal of hundreds of thousands, maybe more, barrels per day of Iranian oil from global supply.
That's a massive supply shock.
Massive. It would likely cause Brent crude to spike $5, $10, maybe even more per barrel. And it would trigger a huge flight to safety across all assets, higher energy prices, more inflation fear. It's the big weekend risk everyone's hedging against.
Wow. Okay, so summing up this incredibly packed week, we've got tariffs, border clashes, ceasefire tests, IMF warnings, a data fog, bank credit checks, the AI chip tests, CPI, and an Iran sanctions deadline. For risk managers trying to navigate this, what are the key portfolio takeaways from our sources?
The clear message is adopt a much more defensive stance, significantly defensive.
Meaning reduce exposure where?
Given the tariff risk, the China slowdown, the EM debt worries, the advice is to reduce exposure to anything heavily tied to China, like FXI or KWM ETFs. Also reduce broader emerging market equities, cyclical industrial stocks that get hit by trade wars, and maybe volatile semiconductor equipment makers like Applied Materials or Lam Research.
And where should that money go instead?
Increase exposure to. Pivot towards increasing exposure to defensive quality. That means U.S. mega cap tech. Think Apple, Microsoft. They're seen as having strong balance sheets, pricing power, more resilient businesses.
Healthcare, too.
Yeah, healthcare staples like Johnson & Johnson, Abbott Labs, less tied to the economic cycle. And gold, GLD, remains a key geopolitical hedge against all these shocks.
And given all the binary risks, maybe some volatility protection.
Explicitly recommended. Using VIX calls to hedge against sharp market swings, especially heading into that potential JCPOA deadline over the weekend, and maybe being long overdue U.S. dollar against EM currencies.
It's really striking how much critical market-moving information is crammed into just these 5 days, the convergence you mentioned at the start.
It really is. And what stands out to me, thinking about the bigger picture, is how the path forward for inflation, trade, credit risk over the next year or 18 months isn't really being defined by the economic data we normally rely on.
Because that data is either missing or overshadowed.
Exactly. Instead, the trajectory seems to hinge on these three huge, uncertain, low probability but high impact binary events. Do the 130% tariffs actually get fully implemented? Does the Gaza Phase 1 deal hold? Does the Iran sanctions snapback happen?
And the Federal Reserve, which is supposed to navigate using economic data, is stuck in this data fog, largely blind.
Precisely. So the provocative thought maybe is this. What does it signal for global stability, for markets, for policy itself, when the immediate future feels like it's being driven more by calculated geopolitical gambles, like President Trump's sudden tariff announcement, than by the measured economic indicators that policymakers, like the Fed, can't even properly access right now because of domestic political dysfunction?
That tension between geopolitical force majeure and the vacuum where reliable data should be seems like the defining conflict that's going to shape things well beyond just this week.
I think that's exactly right. That conflict is going to resonate for a long time.